Well, special day, 2-2-2-2-0-2-2, and we have people arriving already. Okay, thank you. I just met Tom and his wife last fall. I found out about the shop over there, so it's just been a gradual evolution, and suddenly it was like, all right, come on the show, see what we can talk about.
I like to simplify gold and silver down to this. I used to have a fellow that come into our store. He was a regular buyer, and his wife used to give him a hard time. His name was Mike. And he would laugh, and he'd said to me, she'd say, you're spending money on that. And he goes, no, I'm not. I'm trading one kind of money for another. And I thought, that's brilliant. It's not like you're going down and buy a TV that's going to end up a landfill site one day. So really all you do is, you know, you're swapping 20s for 100s in a sense, right? So there's that. And it never even dawned on me being in the business to frame it that way. All right, until he said it. So that's one thing. The other thing people get confused on is which is better, silver or gold. So I'll speak to that. Neither. They're both perfectly good. Push come to shove, close your eyes and point, you'd be fine with either. The real considerations come down to bulk. So for example, a person asked me the other day, said, if I buy $50,000 in silver, how much is it going to weigh? And I said, that's a good question. So I did the calculation. I said, well, it's going to weigh about as much as I do, about 180 pounds. So that's an awful lot of bulk. So the question is, do you have a place to store that much bulk? If you had to move it, are you able to carry that? Is that too much? So those are factors, and increments are factors too. I have another analogy that I recently came up with that, you know, because we have anything from fractional instruments down as small as, like, you know, we have these, we don't sell them, but these Valcambi bars that are, you know, these tiny little fractional silver that you can break off, right? And
oh yeah.
And we have a product by Royal Canadian Mint called a maple gram, which is a tiny little wee, looks just like a Royal Canadian Mint gold maple, but it's about that big. It's about a quarter inch, very, very small. So there's those. So increments matter, because my analogy is this. If you were going on an extended vacation for a year and all you could take with you was cash, and you knew that nobody was going to be able to make change, what increments would you take with you? You'd take dimes, quarters, you know, dollar, $2 bill, five, because you're not going to get change. Well, not that you wouldn't get change from gold and silver, but it's sort of the same thing. If later down the road you want to divest yourself of a bit and cash it in, if you only have big increments, you're going to be having to cash in a lot. And let's say silver and gold go to astronomical numbers, which some predict they will. That would be an awful lot of a commitment to cash in at once. You might not want that. So having a number of different increments is probably the most important thing, really, to consider. And if you'd have asked me 10 years ago, do you think people will be trading silver for goods at some point? And I said, probably not. They'll probably bring it back to a bullion dealer or wherever they happen to be and trade it in for cash. But I'm beginning to think that that could be a real possibility, because if the systems break down even temporarily, I mean, they don't have to break down forever. They only have to break down for a couple months to cause a lot of devastation. And having something for a transaction could make the difference between eating or getting gas in your car or getting across a border. You know what I mean?
Because things are quite turbulent right now and have been for a while increasingly, you know, there has been a lot of attention to different modes of value and thinking of things that may not even be of value to me, but would be of value to somebody else, and having some of those on hand. Welcome to Living on Purpose.
Yeah, hello, everybody.
You're good to stay on for a bit, are you?
Yeah, I set aside a couple hours just in case.
Okay, well, that's fabulous.
Usually once you start talking about this subject with people, and when you get to the question period, it usually continues for a while. People get very curious, and there's a lack of knowledge generally about it. So
we don't even know, like, we're fish not knowing we're in water, and it's just what we've become familiar with, right?
Yeah, people accept the world as they see it, as has been said before, right? As it's presented to them.
How did your speaking engagement go last week?
That's fine. Yeah, it was really well received. Kind of shocked a lot of people, some of the statements I made, but they, in fact, are true statements and unpleasant to hear. But I think it's important people hear the raw honesty of particularly of their financial situation.
Yeah, well, that's what we want to know more about tonight, along with anything else you want to share.
For sure.
How many people were out? This was in Lindsay, Ontario.
Oh, quite a few, 90 probably.
Yeah. Have you spoken in front of that many people before?
Oh, yeah. I grew up speaking, doing public speaking and stuff. So it's pretty familiar for me. I get a little nervous. You know, everybody gets really, people are terrified of public speaking. I'm not. I get the normal nervousness, which is, it just kind of alerts you to pay attention more than anything. So any mistakes you make, you can always laugh them off. And well, I completely forgot what I was talking about one time in the last presentation. I was like looking at my wife, what was I just talking about?
Where was I going?
How's it going with that? Okay, well, next comment, you know, you just roll with it.
I brought some of my keepsakes along for tonight's call.
Oh, yeah?
I got this beautiful 10-ounce silver bar there the other day.
Yeah, the Nadir bars, the Turkish bars, yeah.
What do you call them? Nadir Turkish bars?
Nadir, it's a Turkish mint.
Oh, Nadir, I see. Yeah, right.
Yeah, there's small mints all over the world. People have never even heard of some, like some mining companies actually have mints attached to their facilities. Like Silver Majestic is a big Canadian company who has one of the bigger silver only mines in Mexico. And Keith Neumeyer, the guy that runs it, he set up his own line of bullion products that have made by a contractor. So yeah, there's all kinds of different mints out there around the world. Every once in a while, we stumble onto something we've never seen before and go, where's this from?
One of the coins I got when I saw Virginia last, a week or so ago, I think it was from a different mint than from before.
Yeah, it could have been.
I think it had a different stamp on it, yeah.
Certain products come into vogue and go out. Like something that was really popular for a lot of years was Johnson Matthey. And of course, their stuff is still floating around out there. But they recently got out of the refining. I think they still exist in some capacity, but they got out of the refining and sold off to Asahi Industries. And now they've taken over all of their product line. But those old Johnson Matthey's were very sought after. There's still some old timers out there that if you tell them you got Johnson Matthey's, they'll drive 100 miles to buy them from you, you know.
I thought that Tom and I could talk for a while here. At least I'll probably get a few questions in here and there and let him talk. My name is Lynn Thompson, and I know some of you and some of you I don't. So that's really great that you've shown up. And I just met Tom and his wife, Virginia, in the last few months at Durham Precious Metals in Whitby. And it's so wonderful that you're here, because I think more than ever, we really need to be looking at what is going on with our financial system and what we can do to prepare physically as well as just mentally and emotionally to be more aware of what is going on and just how we can ease into a whole new time that we've never probably really been able to imagine. So I just welcome you to share your insights with us, Tom. And I'm excited by what we talked about a couple of weeks ago in advance of you coming on. So I've made a few notes, but I don't think I really need them because I know you know what you're going to talk about.
Well, some of it will be prompted by the flow of the conversation, as it usually is. I have a couple of talking points that I'll try to squeeze in here, things that I think are points of interest, at least to me. They may or may not be to others, but yeah, we'll just let it ebb and flow as it naturally does.
Well, let's start with an interesting thing that just happened the other day. I was with my niece, and I started talking to her about the birth certificate and how everybody is registered and that we're actually worth something and we're actually traded. And so she got out her birth certificate. It's an original, well, so-called original, looking pretty tattered from 1990. And I said, okay, pull it out of the little plastic sleeve you have in and turn it over and see what it says. And it said banknote.
Yeah, it says Canadian Banknote Company on the bottom. They're basically printed on a type of commercial paper, apparently. I don't know what the reason for that is, but they decided to print it on like a type of commercial paper, similar to what they used to print bills on.
Yeah. And you wouldn't think you'd see that. I just reordered my birth certificate last year. So I don't have that. I just looked at it again. I have a registration number, but I don't have the banknote thing on there. But I hadn't seen that. And it was really, she was quite surprised to see that on there.
Yeah, most people are unaware of it. And the print is extremely small, so it's not really visible to the naked eye. So.
Yeah, exactly.
That's kind of interesting.
one of the things that stood out to me from what we talked about was this idea that things are built on debt. And what is it you said? You can't pay debt with an instrument of debt?
Well, you can't pay for something with debt. How do you pay with debt? So it's interesting. Let's actually talk about how it actually functions. I just recently did a video on this because this is something that a lot of people put out. It's kind of my myth busting thing that I tend to do because I've thought about this a long time. And I thought, you know, you listen to other people talk about the problems, the functional structural problems with our banking system. Well, the first structural problem is that approximately half the world doesn't have a bank account. For example, the Indian economy, a lot of farmers in India, and they're basically operating in a cash economy and have for a lot of years, right? So obviously the system has a number of difficulties servicing certain people. Now that could be an infrastructure problem. It could be a number of different things, but suffice to say, we've been doing this for how many hundreds of years and still certain people are not benefiting from that. They have no access to capital, right? So it has a number of problems. And getting past that, let's just talk more about the way it does work. So a lot of people say, well, we create money out of thin air. I believed that for a long time. And then I began to think about it. I said, do we really create money out of thin air? I mean, it seems a little strange to me that these institutions, when you go to borrow, quote unquote, borrow money, there's an awful lot of talk about, you know, assets and security and backing that up with something and promise to pay. So I got to wonder when they're doing this on the scale of millions and billions of dollars, that there must be something backing it up, right? And so really, my opinion is that from my research is that it's being backed up by basically us, our earning potential and our ability to pay the taxes. So given that most of us are going to go to work every day because we have to do that to feed and shelter ourselves, that's a pretty solid base of people operating and using this financial system, which is a closed system. And that's kind of what backs up our currency. So to say that it comes out of thin air is kind of silly. Now, if you actually get down to the functions of how it works, in my opinion, from my research, let's just talk about like a scenario, okay? So a mortgage, you go to buy $1 million home. So what the bank does is they basically are just given a license to put credits in your account, discharge the debts that were involved in building and processing that house, you know, the builder and the carpenters and plumbers and all the people would get their debts discharged. And then there would be one debt left and that would be you and the bank. So you have to take your labor and your energy and go out and extract some of those units from the general supply that's moving between people and bring them back and distinguish the debt with the bank. And when that's done, it's done. It's simply crossed off the ledger. So let's get down to the individual transaction. So your first mortgage payment, let's say it's $2,000. So typically we've all seen an amortization schedule or we're aware of it. So most of what you pay initially would be interest. So let's just pick an arbitrary number. Let's say that 1% of it is principal and the rest is interest. So on a $2,000 payment, there'd be $20 in principal and $1,980 in interest. So what happens is when that first payment is made, the $1,980 goes on the bank's balance sheet as their profit. The $20 that's principal gets erased and disappears the same way it came into existence. Now you say, well, wait a minute. You're telling me money comes into existence and out again? Yeah, of course, because banking, really the word banking, I think is a misnomer. I think we need to call it accounting because what's really happening is they're simply accounting for all of the transactions that are part of that home and acting as their fiduciary and extinguishing those debts. So for example, if you had a debt with a friend and you said, look, you know, you owe me a certain amount of time or whatever the debt may be, and you decide to reduce it to writing, when the debt was settled, what would you do with the piece of paper? You'd crumple it up, throw it away. So it would be crossed off the ledger because the accounting is now resolved. That's actually how banking works. And the majority of people have no clue about how that works. In fact, I had a brother-in-law who was a bank manager for 22 years, and I got into a debate with him about that. And he thought I was crazy. And I said, well, this is exactly how it works. I said, if you don't believe me, go to the Federal Reserve's website. One of the Federal Reserve websites talks about modern money mechanics and how it actually works. So even at his stature and his level, working with it all those years, was not aware of that. And when he finally realized I was right, he apologized and said, wow, I can't believe I didn't know that. So that's how little people understand it. Even people that work with it don't truly understand it.
Well, it's interesting because my father's father was the bank manager in Brooklyn of the Bank of Commerce before it became the Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. And so, you know, they had bank account number one and all this kind of thing. But yeah, like when a bank says, well, we've made all this money, as if that's a good thing. Like, how do banks make money? I mean, they're making money on us, aren't they?
By loaning, or quote unquote loaning, as I just explained, it's not really a loan. They don't have anything to loan. What they do is they have a license to be a fiduciary over the accounting transactions. So being that these little pieces of paper or digital units we use, they're very handy. People take for granted how useful the banking system is. It's a real shame that it doesn't service more of the people of the world, because I believe used properly, it's a really, really handy system. And if anybody doesn't believe it's handy, wait till it's not there. If it was ever not there, I mean, we totally take it for granted how much facility. If you go back to the history of trade and the cumbersome, you know, trades that people would have to go through, and, you know, you can't divide a duck into a cow kind of trade type of thing. Having something where we can store some of our economic energy, at least temporarily, if not permanently, is it really useful for creating that transactional layer between these cumbersome trades? You know, instead of storing up our energy in ducks and geese and cows, we store it up in these pieces of paper that we all sort of agree we're going to pass back and forth. That's a pretty handy thing, considering many of us work in occupations where we don't even have something of substance to give somebody. It's a service. So when the money system breaks down, it starts to cause problems. We begin to really see just how important it really is.
Okay, well, I mean, right now, as of this week, the government can ask banks to freeze accounts, and they do. And I know that for a while, people have been withdrawing cash from banks. And I mean, does that sort of become a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy, you know, in terms of a run on the banks, if people think that it's not safe to have your money in the bank if it can be seized or frozen?
Well, that's a personal point of view, and they've always sort of had that power. I mean, most of us don't have time to read these big contracts that we get with our bank account and stuff, but I'll almost guarantee if you pour through that and read the fine details, you'll find that there's a lot of surprises in there that you didn't know existed. So they've always had that power to be able to do that kind of thing. Most of us have never rubbed up against the system in a way that they would do that. So we're just not aware that they've had that kind of power.
Yeah, there's this bank manager I was talking to last year when I was attempting to redeem a GIC early. And I thought, oh, maybe part of my job is to educate him a bit on what I'd been learning from someone who's learned like you, who I was talking to. He had no idea about bail-ins.
Yeah, the official stance that I got was less of a positive declaration of bail-ins. And I've never actually gone and dug up the data on it to see if it exists. But in couched language, they kind of announced back in 08 or 09 when they went through our version of the 08 collapse, which was pretty tame in Canada compared to what happened in the US. They had stated, well, we won't be doing bailouts next time, as if there was going to be a next time. But I personally believe that 08 didn't really solve anything, because I think the system has such deep structural problems. And I heard a guy the other day say it well, because he said, it gets to the point where the math becomes so complicated that they can't solve it, because financial institutions worldwide are so tied in with each other. I heard a guy once describe it like this. He said, imagine a big bowl of wet spaghetti, and every strand in there is a financial institution, and every other strand of spaghetti it touches is a connection or a transaction or an agreement with another institution. So if you pull a big, long 18-inch strand of spaghetti out of there, how many connections are in that wet bowl of massive spaghetti? And that's our financial system worldwide right now, with all these various different derivatives and unregulated trades and stuff. It's Warren Buffett said that derivatives are, what did they call, financial nuclear time bombs or something like that. Yeah. And that's what started to unwind in 08. And most people have no idea how those are structured. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, people blame all kinds of different things for the problem. And it's easy to do that when people have no understanding of the structure of it. Going back to, I personally believe they didn't solve anything in 08. They kind of just put some Band-Aids on it and kept pushing forward, and they've been struggling to unwind this complicated math ever since.
So what do you think, if there wasn't all this handy pile of bills that we value and that we base our self-worth on even at times, if we didn't have those pieces of paper and just regular coins, not silver coins, anything of value, how would we function?
Well, let me speak to that in a practical way. There have been economic problems around the planet in relatively large scale, and countries like Argentina went through quite a bit of this. Venezuela is going through it right now. Zimbabwe went through it. So it's not new. So what often happened in, if you go back to the hyperinflation in Weimar in Germany, apparently there were, I forget the number, but there were a number of community currencies that cropped up. So what people did was they said, well, if we don't have little pieces of paper that the government gives us, we'll just create our own. So communities that work together would create community currency that they could trade back and forth and just agree. We just all agree, because really, since currency is just a piece of paper without any inherent value of its own, I mean, it'd be good for a fire starter, but since it doesn't have any inherent value of its own, what's to stop individuals from just agreeing that we're all going to accept this as a form of trade between us? And in fact, they did. And this has been a common response in many of these situations where the facilities and systems that we're used to fall down. Naturally, people gravitate to something very similar that they just do their own privately. During the Zimbabwe hyperinflation, they were using fuel as currency. So a number of different things have been used in these situations over the years. I mean, they've used shiny rocks, they've used seashells, they've used notches in sticks. The notches in sticks that went through Britain lasted almost 600 years. They were actually a really good system.
Wow.
That lasted for a long, long time. So they've tried all kinds of different things as that medium. The reason they come full circle to gold eventually and silver is a number of things that it does that other things don't do. So for example, if you're using a specific type of seashell, well, all some industrious person has to do is go find more of them seashells somewhere else, spend a lot of time collecting them up, and suddenly they're the richest guy in the community. So it causes a number of issues. The rarity and the difficulty of getting gold and silver, also its permanence. I often joke with people and say, well, if that gold maple could have gold in it that was melted down from a Spanish galleon that was at the bottom of the ocean 500 years ago. That's how durable it is. And so because of its durability, it's acted as money. Yes, certainly it requires a certain amount of trust among us to say, okay, yeah, I will accept that as payment. But being that, for example, if you had to mine your own gold, for example, if you had to go and pan it, there'd be a lot of work involved, and you'd have to assay it and melt it down. And if you wanted to make it into a coin, you'd have to create a stamping machine or carve it by hand or something. So there'd be a lot of labor and energy that went into that particular item. Now, if that was the case and you were holding that, would you part with that to another person for nothing? You wouldn't. You would want something that you perceive of value from that other person before you would give that up. So somebody comes and says, well, I have this used car. Okay, yeah, we agree. This lump of gold and that used car are equal value. So once you have gotten to that point, all values are sort of relative. This is another thing. I'm sort of getting off track here, but so now I've forgotten my thought that I started out there. See, I'm doing it again. I get in these complex trails and I forget my thought. Where did we start out on that?
Oh, I agreed upon value in a community.
Right, right. So that could be one way people could do that. Now, so if you had worked, yeah, that was my thought. If you had worked for that piece of gold, you would not trade that and give it away. So the other person would have had to trade something of value to that. Now they would naturally impart their perceived value in that piece of gold. So you can see how this would never, ever change. So nobody's going to just trust that, well, the gold's not worth anything, I'll just leave it there. Nobody's going to leave a kilo of gold and walk away from it because someone said, oh, we all agreed that gold isn't worthwhile. So everything in this is really an agreement between the people. Whether or not we're aware that we're agreeing to it or not consciously, it is actually an agreement. And so where currency breaks down eventually, because it doesn't have the property of the labor built into it, nobody has that intrinsic, entrenched feeling of, I put a lot of work into this and I will not give it up for nothing, right? So it has that unique quality. You can argue, well, the $100 bill is the same. But the challenge with currency, and I come up with this phrase, the truth about currency is built into the name. Currency is derived from current, meaning right now. So I often say this, repeat after me, currency only has value currently. It cannot hold value over time due to the nature of the way it is used and its ebb and flow and its expansive ability and contractive ability. It really cannot transmit value over a long period of time. That is where gold and silver become important, because we've more so agreed that the labor has, well, this is another thing. Currency is usually something that we issue on a promise of productivity in the future. That's why all the laws necessary around money, because we create the currency, but we haven't created the labor yet. It's a promise to create it later. What if people don't keep that promise? That creates another wrinkle and another problem, right? So being that that is the nature of it, money debts are actually never really settled. They're constantly moving. The nature of that debt continues and moves around. In fact, there's a court case in the U.S., Stanek versus White, in the judge's comments. He actually talks about the nature of debt and its permanence. And I think the comment that he made was some aspect of the debt still exists. He didn't clarify on that because, of course, you can't, because we don't know where that debt went now. Once it's settled, it moves on and it's carried by somebody else. So there's this circular nature to the system in that regard. Interesting and very difficult to get a bead on where you are in that system due to that. Whereas if you pay for something with gold, being that the intrinsic value is in there, the labor went in, we agree that that debt is settled. That's an actual settled debt because you've given something of solid value. It's permanent and you can hold it in your hand. Now, people will disagree on that, but that's the way I see it.
Well, speaking of holding it in your hand, I got this coin from you guys. Nice silver maple, yeah. And this was what really intrigued me when we first talked last fall, when I found your shop in Whitby, is asking you, well, how do we value this not compared to currency?
Right, because right now we're reliant on the spot price, which is decided by a financial algorithm set up, I believe, out of the London Bullion Market Association, or a consortium of financial people that weigh in on it and agree on that. So that's sort of, in some ways, arbitrary. Of course, you know, if we look at mining costs and the general cost of extracting silver and bringing it to the market, that has a bearing on it, you know, because those mining costs would be based on equipment and labor and all the various things that go into a company participating in that industry. So, yeah.
I know, but I think that probably comes back to when you're talking about a community agreeing on something being of a certain value. I mean, it's hard to say how this will all unfold. I was thinking about this Gulf Island I know in BC where they have their own mint. They've had their own mint for years. They have their own economy.
Oh, is that Salt Springs Island?
Laskiti.
Oh, okay. Because there was a Salt Springs Island, I believe, off of the West Coast that had their own community currency.
Salt Spring Island, yes.
Salt Spring Island currency. It was very successful. Another one that was really big, one of the biggest, was Ithaca Hours in upstate New York. They had a community currency going there. And there's a number of them that have been operating in real time around the world. There's a system called the LETS system that's been operating for a long, long time as well. So
I haven't heard about that for a long time, but I remember that. Yeah.
I used to be friends with a fellow who was really big on talking about the LETS system. He used to go around and lecture on it to people.
And what was his name?
I forget his name. It was a very unusual name. And I was talking to a fellow the other day and he reminded me of the name and it went right out of my head. But yeah, he was quite passionate about it. He actually used it to travel around one time. He traveled around the world using the LUT system just to prove that it worked. So he went overseas and everything, and he stayed in bed and breakfasts using this LUT system just to make the point that it was. Actually, this guy's a real genius. He's a card counter. He's able to actually still find casinos that will let him in. He's never really worked because he's a genius at card counting, and he's able to sustain himself by traveling around to casinos around the world and card counting. So
Okay, so I have some comments here from Christina in the audience. Is this about the LET system, Christina? It was successful, but the SS currency was attached to the Bank of Montreal, so still in the same game?
Yeah, possibly. I don't know the depth of it. I just know that it existed. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And she also mentioned earlier that her dad was the senior vice president for CIBC, then the controller for the Vatican.
Oh, wow. Anything
about that?
No, not much about that. I don't really know the whole depth and the intrigue of the LET system. I just kind of know that it existed and there were some people that did good things with it at a time. But, you know, systems are run by people and people are corruptible.
Yeah. Well, now you had an interesting story that you told me that set up sort of an example of what you were talking about. You know, that one where the father sends his son off.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's kind of a legal distinction, but I use it because it makes a point. So I'll tell the story and you already know the answers. So I'll just give the answers away and just go through it, what typically people answer. So the story goes like this. All right. So we're in Whitby. If you know the four corners in Whitby, which is Brock and Dundas, we're two blocks east at the corner of Athol and Dundas Street. There's a big brick building right beside us that has the post office in it up at the corner there. And we're the next building over, the green stucco building.
Just right. A little hole in the wall there.
Yeah, small place. Yeah, it's not big.
DurhamPreciousMetals.com. Lots of info on there.
Just definitely enough to get you around. And anybody who has questions, feel free to call. Don't sit in the dark and do what some people have done and call me up and tell me you've been waiting 2 years to do this. Call me up and talk to me and let me walk you through it. And most people, once they are given a pep talk and understand it better and realize it isn't this big thing, this big mysterious thing. I mean, many times I'll say to people that are really struggling with it, I'll say, look, drop down some money and buy an ounce of silver and take it home. Just buy one and take it home.
Yeah.
And just get it in your hand and go home and just go through the experience. It's not a lot. And you know what will happen for people like that? They go home and they get right with it and they come back because now they've made a decision and they've got past that initial fear. And once you're through that, it's clear sailing. You realize that all the things that you thought were a big deal don't even exist.